Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
All right, folks, let me catch you up to speed here. Previously on Just Another Fanboy, episode number 210, I had gotten together over the weekend with Frank A. Rincon and Bill McGonnell from the Half Hour Wasted podcast to talk about Monty Python. All three of us are huge fans, and as this past Tuesday, October 5th, was the 52nd anniversary of Monty Python's Flying Circus, I thought it was perfect to sit down and talk about it. But about an hour into our Skype call, my Skype just failed on me. And so we were at a moment within the episode in which we had just started counting down our top five favorite Monty Python sketches of all time. Bill had chosen the cheese shop for his number five, and Frank had chosen Confuse a Cat for his number five. He was telling a story about how just being random isn't always funny. And suddenly that's when Skype failed on us. So when I put the episode together, I made a little joke out of it as if the guy editing the episode dropped an avocado into the editing bay. And then we ended the episode there with a to be continued. And now we're starting it back up today, part two of another Monty Python episode. And we just take up right where we left off when the episode exploded on Tuesday. Here you go. Have fun. Talk to you later. It was partway Frank was talking about the taco, and then I got this little box that said, "We're sorry, something went wrong. Please reload Skype."
I apologize for that, guys.
No, that was it was on my end.
Okay.
Frank!
So the punchline to that was that the CEO, well, not CEO, but the executive said, because it's random.
Because it's random.
And you know, that did not have with Confused a Cat, it has a story involved in the randomness to where the CEO just thought random was funny.
And my response to Frank was that man's name was Lorne Michaels.
Yeah, random doesn't just automatically make funny.
Exactly.
There has to be a method to it. And I think one of the best things about that sketch is after they do all the weird stuff, I mean, there's a purpose to it. They're not just doing it to be weird. They're trying to confuse the cat. They're trying to shake it out of its melancholy. And the cat just sits there in the yard, calmly watching all the weird stuff that's going on. And then when they're done, John Cleese's character is like, "Hope to God it works." And then finally the cat just kind of walks away like, "All right, I've been," because he's been sitting there the whole time, even beforehand.
Right.
And the goal was to shake him up enough that he goes back to his life. And he does. And you're just like, yay. And it's just it's so good.
That was the problem. The poor cat was clearly in a deep malaise, clearly suffering a deep and profound case of ennui.
Yes. And moping.
Ooh. Yeah. So when John Cleese gets the troops out in front of the truck and he slaps his riding crop up against his shoulder and says, "Gentlemen, confuse the cat."
Yes.
And then
so serious. They're so serious about such a silly thing. Your cat needs to be confused.
That skit also ends with other services that Confuse a Cat provides. A Maze of All, Stout, Puzzle a Puma, Startle a Thompson's Gazelle, Bewilder Beast Incorporated, and Distract a Bee.
That's good stuff. That's good stuff. All right. My number five is a sketch called Come Back to My Place. This is a very, very short sketch, and it's on film. John Cleese plays a policeman, and Michael Palin runs up to him to tell him that someone has stolen his wallet and keys from a park bench. John Cleese tells him, asks him, well, did you see who might have done it? Anybody? No, I didn't see anything. Oh, there's not much we can do about that. Then they stand there for a moment, and finally Michael Palin just looks at him and goes, would you like to come back to my place? And John Cleese just says, yeah, all right.
Inspector.
Yes, sir.
I was sitting on a park bench just now, and I put my coat down. And when I picked it up again, I found my wallet had gone, and £15 had been stolen.
Did you see anyone?
No one at all.
Well, there's very little we can do about that, sir.
Do you want to come back to my place? Yeah, all right.
And then they go off, and I just, there's just something about that I love so much.
The brevity and the punchline of it that comes out of nowhere is just brilliant.
And there's a slight moment when he asks him, would you like to come back to my place? And John kind of, you can see him kind of think about it for a moment. Yeah, all right. And then they walk in. It's such a simple little thing, and it's one that makes me laugh every time. Bill, your number four.
Well, obviously because I'm quite in touch with today's politics, my number four sketch is the North Minehead by-elections.
Here at Luton, it's a three-cornered fight between Alan Jones, Sensible Party, in the middle, Tarquin, Fim, Tim, Lim, Bim, Wim, Bim, Lim, Bustop, Fatang, Fatang, Ole, Biscuit Barrel, Silly Party, and Kevin Phillips, Bong, the slightly silly candidate.
Alan Jones.
On the left, Sensible Party.
9,112. Kevin Phillips, Bong.
On the right, slightly silly.
Naught. Quinn, Fim, Tim, Lim, Bim, Wim, Bim, Limber, Stop, Fatang, Fatang, Ole, Biscuit Barrel.
Silly.
12,441.
And so the silly party has taken Luton.
I don't know, you can't do that sketch these days, though, so let's just gloss over it before this is picked up by CNN and run with it. That's kind of publicity you don't want.
This is the one with the silly party and the not-so-silly party. And
the slightly silly party.
There's like a very silly party where the guy has this long string of noises for his name. Is that the one we're talking about?
That's exactly right. Yes. And that's one of my favorite moments of Michael Palin standing there in the clown suit, kind of listing to one side.
Yes.
Nothing. A fairly beatific look on his face. It just speaks to me.
Kevin Phillips Bong.
Exactly. Yes.
And then you have the one guy that every once in a while will show up on camera and say, can I just say that this is the first time I've ever been on television? No, I'm sorry. There isn't enough time.
Moving on.
Yeah, that's a good one. That is another one that was the first I had come across that was in audio. And it was, I think it was on that final ripoff, and it was actually from one of their live performances. So it probably came off the Live at City Center. I think that was an album that they put out at one point. Bill is frozen. I don't know if we've lost him as well.
He's moving to me.
Mm. Just on my end. And I can only see one name. He had two names on there. Bill, are you still there?
Yes, I'm still here. And great. Darn glad to be it.
Bill, bravo. Your description of Michael Palin listing is for me, One of the great visual gags, because I believe his mouth is open and he's just not saying anything. He's like,
yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah,
that's a good one. All right, Frank, your number four.
The fish slapping dance.
Oh,
short, to the point, very silly.
So I'll say real quick, if any one of us during our list chooses one that's on somebody else's list, we have to go ahead and say that, and then, of course, we'll skip it when we come to that. But that was my number one.
Oh, what?
The fish slapping dance is the greatest thing ever put to film, if only for the fact that they had to gather a crew together, get on a truck, take the equipment to this location, put on costumes, just to slap each other in the face with fishes. That just the idea behind putting it together, the production of this sketch, just adds a bit to the complete silliness of Michael Palin in an explorer. You know, they're both in explorer's outfits, Michael Palin and John Cleese in their little shorts and their pith helmets. But Michael Palin with those tiny little fish and his little dance and slapping John Cleese in the face with them. And it's, yeah, good Lord, it's less than a minute. It might even be 30 seconds or more, and it's genius.
And you get the punchline of the big fish and yes. The knock in the water, which I think really tops it, because the little slappy fishes, I think I remember when I first saw this, I thought it was just going to be the little slappy fishes and then they were going to stop and bow. I thought yes. That's how it was going to end.
Yes.
And then the giant fish coming out is just such a silly topper.
Well, there's a guy if you've seen the documentary Almost the Truth, one of the episodes, as they're talking about the show, they talk to a lot of other celebrities about Monty Python, and they talk about their favorite sketches, and a lot of them, of course, are British comedians. And there's this guy, I don't recognize him, I'm not sure who he is, but he's talking about the fish slapping dance and how his parents have never enjoyed Monty Python, but his mother loves the fish slapping dance, and he thinks that this is a sketch that crosses all racial, political, religion, you know, all these lines, and that's how you can bring peace to the world, is just drop little TV screens with this sketch loaded on them into war torn areas and let everybody watch the fish slapping dance, and then everything will be fine again. And I think my thought is it's the perfect sketch.
You know, you could argue that it is the predecessor to the animated GIF, because it is such a short little thing and brings joy. And
yes,
and we do that now with little videos like that. It's a brilliant skit.
And if I remember correctly, there's almost a lead up to it. Terry Gilliam's animation with a guy who is trying to make some sort of announcement, and his mouth keeps flying away, and he's chasing his mouth around, and finally he nails his mouth to his face and holds up a little sign that says, "And now for the fish slapping dance." And then we get that. And then it's like, okay, you're almost like, oh, this should be pretty, you know, what are we leading up to here? And it's that. And you just, it's so funny. It's perfect. So my number four is the mouse problem.
Well, it's not a question of wanting to be a mouse. It just sort of happens to you. All of a sudden you realize that's what you want to be.
And when did you first notice these, shall we say, tendencies?
Well, I was about 17, and some mates and me went to a party. And, we had quite a lot to drink, and then some of the fellas there started handing cheese around. Well, just out of curiosity, I tried a bit, and, well, that was that.
Do you guys remember this one?
No, that doesn't ring a bell.
This was like a hard-hitting news magazine piece. Basically, it was like talking about the drug problem in the city, but it was about young men getting together and dressing up like mice.
That's right.
And John Cleese plays a guy who is an anonymous, one of these dirty little perverts, I think, as they call him. And he is describing what a night, a typical evening is when you're dressing up as mice. And he talks about going to these parties and putting the mouse skins on, and somebody starts passing around cheese. And then there's this one moment that he delivers it so perfectly, and it's so dramatic. And he's talking about how, and then at some point someone starts squeaking, and just the way he says it is so funny.
Yes. And what else did these fellas do?
Well, some of them started dressing up as mice a bit. And then when they got the costumes on, they started squeaking.
And then they have footage from one of these parties. Terry Jones comes in dressed as what, the butcher's wife, and she chases the mice up the clock or something like that. It's really funny. It's a really funny sketch. And again, one of those that is played very serious. The acting, none of that is silly. It's a silly topic that's handled incredibly serious.
And that's why it's my number four.
Awesome.
Number four.
Bill, number three.
My number three is the, I'm not actually sure what the title of it is, so my apologies to those who are pedantic out there, but the Abattoir sketch, where John Cleese comes in and tries to sell a couple of construction building people on his new set of flats, which involves beautiful moving sidewalks, going down hallways, showing art projects, and it delivers the people that are on the moving sidewalk into the rotating knives.
Good morning, gentlemen. This is a 12-story block combining classical neo-Georgian features with all the advantages of modern design. The tenants arrive in the entrance hall here, are carried along the corridor on a conveyor belt in extreme comfort and past murals depicting Mediterranean scenes towards the rotating knives. The last 20 feet of the corridor are heavily soundproof. The blood pours down these chutes, mangled flesh slurps into these large...
Excuse me.
Hmm?
Did you say knives?
Rotating knives, yes.
Are you proposing to slaughter our tenants?
Does that not fit in with your plans?
No, we wanted a simple block of flats.
Ah, I see. I hadn't correctly divined your attitude towards your tenants.
Which ends up shocking the people building the apartment because they wanted a block of flats, not an abattoir. At which point, John Cleese says, I clearly haven't divined your attitude towards your guests.
Yes, that's the it's called the architect sketch.
The architect sketch.
Yes, they have all the Gumbies out there.
The architect sketch.
And then, of course, when they don't approve his design, he does what?
Well, he calls them all crybabies, doesn't he, and walks out.
Well, may I ask you to reconsider? I mean, you wouldn't regret it. Think of the tourist trade.
No, it's just that we wanted a block of flats and not an abattoir.
Yes, but of course that's just the sort of blinkered Philistine pig ignorance I've come to expect. Creative garbage. You sit there on your loathsome spotty behind, squeezing blackheads, not caring a tinker's cuss about the struggling artist. You excrement! You lousy, hypocritical, whining toadies! With your lousy colored TV sets and your Tony Jackson golf clubs and your bleeding Masonic handshakes, you wouldn't let me join with you, you black, boring bastards! Well, I wouldn't become a Freemason now if you went down on your lousy, stinking, polluted knees and begged me!
And then they bring in the second guy who shows them his block of flats all mounted on a central core. And let's just say the model doesn't go well, but they're okay with it because it does rotating knives.
They're okay with it because it's cheap. And as long as their tenants are light in weight
and relatively sedentary.
Don't move about a lot. They should be fine. But then John Cleese, after berating these guys, that's when we find out they're Masons and he wants to be a Mason as well. And so he's like, well, seriously, if you can put in a good word for me, I'd love to be a Mason. Because he's calling them blackballing. You wouldn't let me join, would you, blackballing bastards? And nobody screams at a person like John Cleese does.
So I love it. Favorite Monty Python episodes is kind of almost literally shooting fish in a barrel, only without so many fish.
And I don't know, is that the sketch that leads into how to spot a Mason?
Oh, my goodness. Probably is. And again, I would have to go back and revisit to be clear on that. So at this point, I'm just going to bow up, pretend I'm right, and challenge anybody to fight me if they don't believe, if they don't share my belief system. So there we go.
And so, and yeah, the sketch opens with all the Gumbies down on the sidewalk, and they're announcing the sketch, and they're going, "The Architect sketch," and the camera doesn't move, and they start pointing up there, "The Architect sketch." And then as we go into the office and the sketch starts, you can still hear the Gumbies out on the street. "Up there!" And Graham Chapman pours a bucket of water out the window, and we see the Gumbies down on the sidewalk soaked, and they're all like, "Ooh." The Gumbies were something that took me a while. I'd never really quite understood what a Gumby was supposed to represent.
Me neither.
I believe they're just basically the Gumbies, the way I understand it. And Bill, you can correct me if I'm wrong. Maybe you know. The way I understand it, the Gumbies are kind of like the working class. They would be like the working class of Britain. The not intelligent. I don't know. That's the way I kind of understood it.
Which is weird. But I have always been mildly unclear on exactly what the Gumbies meant. They got their name from Wellington boots, commonly known as gum boots, by the way. Yes. So that's where they got the name Gumbies. Exactly where they came from is a great question. I assume this is one of those things where if we lived in Britain, we would just get it because right. But I was always fascinated by the Gumbies because there's really no American analog, at least not until pro wrestling became popular in America. So,
yeah, I'm looking at the Monty Python wiki in which they talk about the Gumbies, and they don't really give you any information on what, if that is a
like a cultural reference.
Yes. Or agreed. Yeah. So it makes you ask the question, what's the internet good for?
Exactly.
Thank you.
I used to wear bandanas in that Gumby style. I had learned how to tie it, and it's actually a really nice way to keep your hair out of your face. My hair was long in college, and during the summers I would wear it like that because it's loose enough you could put your hair up in it, and you don't look terribly ridiculous, only slightly ridiculous.
All right, Frank, your number three.
So I chose something from a movie. Are we considering those or the TV show?
That's fine. We never clarified.
So in The Meaning of Life, there's a skit called Goodbye Gifts on the Battlefield. It takes place in in World War I.
If we don't meet again, sir, I'd just like to say it's been a real privilege fighting alongside you, sir.
Yes, well, it's time or place for goodbye speech, eh?
No, me and the lads realise that, sir, but, well, we may never meet again, sir, so...
Yes, all right, Blackett, thanks.
No, just a moment, sir. See, me and the lads, we've had a little whip around, sir. We brought you something, sir. We brought you this, sir.
I don't know what to say. It's a lovely thought.
Thank you.
Well, thank you all.
But I think we better get to the car now. Hang on a sec, sir. We got something else for you as well, sir. Sorry, it's another clock, sir. It was a bit of a mix-up. Walter thought he was buying a present, and Spadger and I had already got the other one.
Well, it's beautiful. I think we'd better get the cover now, sir, and I'll thank you probably later on.
Corporal Sturridge got this for you as well, sir. He didn't know about the others, sir. It's Swiss.
Oh, well, now that is Corporal Sturridge. Good man.
And there's a card, sir, from all of us. Sorry about the blood, sir.
And the guys are about to leap out of a trench to go to probably their death, but right before it, Eric Idle kind of goes, "Wait, before we did do that, we'd like to present you with a gift." And all the pythons are there, and they present their captain with a very ornate clock, which would be very difficult to to have in the trenches. But he says, "Thank you." And then Eric Idle goes, well, there was a bit of miscommunication because they also got you a gift. And two of the pythons lift up a grandfather clock, which, again, is in the trenches. And then Michael Pilon's just like, okay, well, thank you. Thank you very much. And then they go, well, Gerald also got you this, which is a watch. And so now they have three timepieces on the battlefield. The captain is just a little befuddled, but says, well, thank you. Now let's go. And then Eric Idle goes, well, I also made you a cake, which now at this point, it's just everyone's feelings are hurt because the captain wants to go over and do the battle. But Eric Idle is just like talking about how hard everyone worked to get him a cake and stuff.
Let's not even give him the cake.
Yes, exactly. And they just start to become very, their feelings are hurt and stuff. And it's just a brilliant, just 2 minutes of just like misunderstanding. What I like about it is that that is the type of conversation that would happen in an office birthday party, which I'm sure is what they meant to do.
But it's happening during the horrors of war.
Exactly.
Look at him. He worked on that cake like no one else I've ever known. Some nights it was so cold we could hardly move, but Black would be out there slicing the lemons, mixing the sugar and the almonds. I mean, you try to get butter to melt at 15 degrees below zero.
So for that, you can find it on the YouTubes. It's officially titled Goodbye Gifts on the Battlefield. I recommend it.
The line I remember from that is after they all realize that they feel like he's not giving it, you know, he's been given these gifts and he's not giving it the thanks maybe that they feel, because he's like, we're in the middle of a war. We're getting ready to do this battle and this is great, but come on, we got. And so at one point when they're complaining about the cake and Eric Idle's like, you try getting butter to melt at 15 degrees below zero.
Yes. That is a line from it. That is brilliant. From Eric Idle's delivery of that line is brilliant. That is probably one of my least favorite of the Python movies, but that skit really stands out to me.
That's one of the great things about The Meaning of Life, because I think for most Monty Python fans, it is the least favorite of the movies, but some of their greatest sketches come out of that film. That's one of them. The deal with the two guys that are dressed as a tiger. Well, why are they? It doesn't matter how they got my leg. Why are they dressed as a tiger?
don't shoot. We're not a tiger. We were just.
Why are you dressed as a tiger?
Hmm? Oh, why? 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 Oh, isn't this a lovely day today?
Answer the question.
Oh, we were just.
Well, actually, we're dressed like this because. Oh, no, that's not it.
Oh, we did it for a lark, part of a spree. High spirits, you know, simple as that.
Nothing more to it. Well, actually, we're on a mission for British intelligence. There's a pro-czarist Ashanti chief.
No, we're doing it for an advertisement.
Ah, that's it. Forget about the Russians. We're doing an advert for Tiger Brand coffee.
Tiger Brand coffee is a real treat. Even tigers prefer a cup of it to real meat.
Now, look.
All right. We are dressed as a tiger because he had an auntie who did it in 1839, and this is the 50th anniversary.
No, we're doing it for a bet.
God told us to do it.
To tell the truth, we are completely mad. Oh. Yeah. We're inmates of a Bengali psychiatric institution, and we escaped by making this skin out of old used cereal packets.
It doesn't matter.
What?
It doesn't matter why they're dressed as a tiger. Have they got my leg?
They're trying to... No, we're not dressed as a tiger, And then the scene where Michael Palin is trying to get everybody to march up and down the square, but one guy he wants to go practice the piano, and the other guy wants to go read a book, and just some great sketches come out of that film. They just weren't able to bring them together in such a way to make the film even as good as any of the previous ones.
When I was researching for favorite skits, that skit about the tigers and the leg did come up. And while I wouldn't say that's my favorite skit, it has a line that I've always loved, which is, they're dressed up as tigers. One of them says, we're doing a commercial for Tiger Brand Coffee. And the other one goes, oh, yes, Tiger Brand coffee is a real treat. Even tigers prefer it to a cup of real meat. That's an honorable mention for sure.
All right. My my number three is Rival Documentaries. This is this starts out with John Cleese standing in a field and he's doing a documentary. He's a he's the guy in front of the camera and he's talking about the trees and hills that are Sir Walter Scott's country. And then Michael Palin comes up and he kind of taps him on the shoulder and he whispers something to him and John hands him the microphone and Michael Palin's like, thank you. And then he walks off and then the camera follows him. And then he starts his own documentary and about the wood cutting industry or something like that. And then John Cleese comes in back into the shot and he tries to take the microphone back. And at that point, Michael Palin won't give it to him. He's like, no. And then they start fighting and one of them tackles the other one and they're wrestling around and they're grabbing them. Each time one of them gets the microphone, they start up their documentary real quick. They're chasing each other around in the field. And it's a really fun one.
In commercial terms, a coniferous cornucopia, an evergreen Eldorado, a tree-lined treasure trove. No. A fat fir cone future for the financiers. But what are the costs? Go away in human terms. Who are the casualties?
For this was Sir Walter Scott's country. In many of his finest romances, such as Guy Mannering or Red Gaunt. No, Scott showed himself to be not only a
The spruces and firs of this forest were used to create a
also a writer of humour and
timber resources are being used up at the rate of
one man who knew Scott was Angus Tinker.
That one does not bop into my head. I don't remember that one.
There's even a moment where they're each in their own cars racing down a highway, grabbing the microphone from each other, trying to do their own documentaries and a couple other people get involved. And it's a really good one. If you ever want to look it up, Rival Documentaries.
Got it.
That's what happens when you're on a flatbed and you don't have doors you can lock.
Right. And of course, whenever they do one of those scenes, because there's a couple of sketches where they're racing down the road in their cars, you can see that they're actually going about 4 miles an hour.
Yeah.
All right, Bill, you're number two.
My number two is the very popular, very bougie fresh fruit skit, because that was probably one of the first skits I ever. That's one of the first skits I remember really striking a nerve with me.
Right, now, self-defense. Tonight I should be carrying on from where I got to last week when I was showing you how to defend yourself against anyone who attacks you armed with a piece of fresh fruit.
We promised we wouldn't do fruit this week.
What do you mean?
Well, we've done fresh fruit for the last 9 weeks.
What's wrong with fruit? You think you know it all, eh?
Can't we do something else for a change?
Like someone who attacks you with a pointed stick.
Pointed sticks? Oh, we want to learn how to defend ourselves against pointed sticks, do we? Getting all iron mighty, eh? Fresh fruit not good enough for you, eh? Oh. Well, I'll tell you something, my lad. When you're walking home tonight and some homicidal maniac comes after you with a bunch of loganberries, don't come crying to me. Passion fruit! When the old sailor lunges at you with the passion fruit, thus...
We've done the passion fruit.
What?
We've done the passion fruit.
We've done oranges, apples, grapefruit.
Oh, and segments.
Pomegranates, greengages.
Grapes, passion fruits.
Lemons.
Plums.
Yeah, and mangoes in syrup.
How about cherries?
We've done them.
Red and black?
Yes.
All right, then. Oh. We haven't done them, have we? Oh. Right!
Again, the sheer joy of absurdity in defending yourself against an intruder or an attacker with fresh fruits.
Yes.
Now, as Eric Idle keeps asking during the sketch, it's like, why can't you show us how to defend someone attacking us with pointed sticks?
Shut up.
He keeps getting told to shut up. Yes. And Eric Idle has told more than once that, someone comes, attacking you with a bunch of boysenberries, don't come running to me or something to that effect. But the part that The part that makes that sketch is the hardest thing for many comedians to pull off. It's the dismount where it keeps escalating and escalating, and you do get to see a tiger be unleashed on one of the four people, and finally the greatest of all Python things, you see what I believe is the first appearance of the 16-ton weight.
The 16-ton weight. Yes. Yep.
So that sketch is it's pioneering. It introduces a lot of concepts that we will enjoy over the next 4 years of Monty Python, or the next 50 years of us enjoying it. So I like fresh fruit, and I make no apologies for it. In fact, I've got some strawberries in the kitchen right this second in the strainer that I've looked at crossways a few times. I'm not sure at all that I am safe in this house.
Bill, doesn't Eric Idle say pointed stick?
Yes.
He enunciate that?
Ted stick. Shut up.
About someone that attacks us with a pointed stick.
Yes, he enunciates very carefully. That was ironic, seeing as I did not enunciate that very well. But he enunciates very carefully a pointed stick.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, in the moment, there's a moment in that sketch because, you know, at first it's a silly sketch where obviously the guy who is running the class has some kind of mental faculty defect. He feels that there are people out there waiting to attack you with fresh fruit, and you need to be able to defend yourself. And that's the fun part of the sketch at that point. But then suddenly he talks Graham Chapman into attacking him with a banana. And there's the great moment where Graham Chapman just kind of listlessly walks forward, holding the banana out in front of him. He's like, no, 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 brandish it, you know, up, over your head. And so he goes, scream. And then Graham Chapman just screams, ah, and then John Cleese just shoots him dead.
Yes.
And it's almost like the sketch just freaking stops right there, because everybody else in the sketch is just like, you shot him. And he's like, whoa, he was attacking me with a banana. And then, of course, once you've shot the man, you eat the banana, thus disarming him.
That's right. I've always had a very dark sense of humor, and I completely blame fresh fruit for that.
Mm-hmm.
In all its forms.
And then that's when he talks the other two into attacking him with the raspberries, each of them a basket each. And they go, just promise you won't shoot me. And he throws the gun away and he's like, are you going to shoot me? Like, No, I wasn't.
And then what you do when someone is attacking you with raspberries is you release the tiger.
And then the really fake stuffed tiger that's obviously on a skateboard.
It's on wheels.
Just comes sliding across the stage.
Yes.
Ah, the sliding. I can visualize that now. That is brilliant.
Another one of the great things about that show is they were not afraid to, you know, well, the tiger's got to look real. No, it doesn't. That's not part of the joke, you know? It doesn't matter what the tiger looks like.
Not so much.
All right.
Frank, hey, by the way, a quick little aside. I did some research and found out that according to Reddit, so you know this is a source of veracity and truth. It says here, Gumbies, going back to Gumbies, what the heck are Gumbies? They are what Britons referred to as special needs populations. They said that Britain in the 70s was very liberal and would allow the so-called Gumbies to hold careers in very important jobs that could put people's lives at risk. And the little towels on their heads, it says here the reply is, wearing a handkerchief on the head is a stereotype of the Englishman on holiday. The Gumbies wear them to represent the fact that they're on a permanent holiday. The source of that entry is Gumbies I Have Known by Professor R.J. Gumby, Dr. L.M. Gumby, Mrs. Enid Scrotum Gumby, and Ralph the Dancing Bear with a foreword by ex-King Zog of Albania, price £17.06 at all good booksellers. So, mystery solved, people. You're welcome.
Well, I can see why the Monty Python wiki doesn't go into detail, because that would not be considered politically correct.
I do feel a bit bad about
right. It's like suddenly I feel like I should not. It's like okay, that I guess it's not that funny.
In 1975, we had to have known that it was something like that. This is not new.
Yeah.
I'm not apologizing for it.
Yeah. Okay. All right, Frank, you're number two.
I don't know what the name of this sketch is, but Renting an Argument. We talked about it earlier. Just a brilliant piece of simple wordplay, especially yes. When Palin reads the definition of what an argument is, and Cleese comes back with, no, it isn't. And then they go back and forth. And it is just so, I feel that is one of those universal skits that you could just put out there and anyone would love.
Is this the right one for an argument?
I've told you once.
No, you haven't.
Yes, I have.
When? Just now.
No, you didn't.
Yes, I did.
Didn't.
I'm
telling you, I did.
You did not.
Oh, I'm sorry. Is this a 5-minute argument or the full half hour?
Oh, just the 5-minute one.
Fine. Thank you. Anyway, I did.
You most certainly did not.
Now, let's get one thing quite clear. I most definitely told you.
You did not.
Yes, I did.
You did not.
Yes, I did.
Didn't.
Yes, I did.
Didn't.
Yes, I did.
No, this isn't an argument.
Yes, it is.
No, it isn't. It's just contradiction.
No, it isn't.
Yes, it is.
It is not.
It is. You just contradicted me.
No, I didn't.
Oh, you did.
No.
You did just
then. No, nonsense.
Oh, look, this is futile.
No, it isn't.
I came here for a good argument.
No, you didn't. You came here for an argument.
Well, an argument's not the same as contradiction.
Can be.
No, it can't. An argument's a connected series of statements to establish a definite proposition.
No, it isn't.
Yes, it is. It isn't just contradiction.
Look, if I argue with you, I must take up a contrary position.
But it isn't just saying no, it isn't.
Yes, it is.
No, it isn't. Argument's an intellectual process. Contradiction is just the automatic gainsaying of anything the other person says.
No, it isn't.
That's the argument clinic. And it's that moment. It's because he says an argument is a collective series of statements intended to establish a proposition. It's not just saying no, it isn't. John Cleese said, yes, it is. And then Michael Palin fires back with, no, it isn't. And I just, that is... That I mean, that's genius. Those, you know, it's not just saying no, it isn't. Yes, it is. No, it isn't. Love it.
That is brilliant writing because that is so simple.
Yeah. Well, everything concept. About that's so brilliant because at one point the so-called arguer just stops.
Yeah.
Because his time is up.
Yeah. Ding. Thank you.
Yes.
It's like that wasn't 5 minutes. Sorry, I'm not allowed to argue unless you've paid. Well, I've just paid. No, you haven't. Ha, I've got you. You wouldn't be arguing unless I've paid. I could be arguing in my spare time.
That's right.
I've had enough of this. No, you haven't. Yeah, that's a great one. That's like I said, that's one that was on that the first time I came across that. It's amazing how a lot of these classic sketches, though I was watching the show on PBS, it's like PBS only aired the same 5 episodes in Kansas or something, because that, you know, that is one of those sketches that the first time I came across it was on that Final Ripoff CD. So audio was the first time I heard it. And it's one of those perfect, you don't need to be in the room with them. You can listen to that sketch and it's just as funny. Yeah. And it's one of those that I thought, I wish we would have done this in our forensics thing instead of the Black Knight scene, because it's just genius.
Well, you'll know next time.
Yes, when I'm reliving my high school days.
That's right.
And it also feels like it takes intellectualism down a peg because of the simplicity of it. You know, it's supposed to be this clinic where they're going to help you and it's about arguing, but it just comes back to yes and no. That's in the end, that's all it is.
Well, in the audio version, it ends somewhat the same way, because I think in the show, he leaves the room. He goes into, in the audio sketch, from what I remember, he leaves the room and he goes into another room to complain. And Eric Idle is in there and he goes, I'd like to complain. And he's like, you'd like to complain? I've had these shoes for a week and the heels are worn right through. And he's like, no, I want to complain about, and then he keeps arguing with him about complaining. So he leaves, he goes into another room, and in the audio version, it's, I think they have the same room, the being hit on the head lessons. in the actual show, but he goes into the room and he's like, hello, I'd like to complain. And then somebody hits him on the head and he goes, ow. And he goes, no, it's wah, wah. And he hits him on the head again. And he goes, ow. And he goes, no, wah, like this, wah. And he hits him again. And he goes, wah. And he goes, good. And he goes, no, I want to complain. He goes, oh, no, that's it's being hit on the head lessons in here. And he says, what a stupid concept. And then the sketch ends on the CD. It's being hit on the head lessons. All right. My number two is more of a visual. Sam Peckinpah's Salad Days.
Oh, my God. Yes. Yes.
I say, anyone for tennis? For
tennis?
He throws the tennis. I say, Nigel, catch. He throws the tennis ball to him, hits Michael Palin in the face, and blood just starts spewing. And it turns into a bloodbath from that point on. It's just, there's really nothing much more to it than that. Just that one moment, because they're such upper class, you know, the crust of society, and they're just so, ooh, so proper and British and polite. And I say, anyone for tennis? No, Nigel, I say, catch. Throws him the tennis ball and bam, blood screaming. People's arms are falling off, getting caught in the piano. And at one point, somebody literally has all the keys to the keyboard on the piano thrust through their chest, and they're flailing about, and that cuts somebody else's head off. And it's just such a stupid bloodbath of a sketch, and it's one of my favorites.
It ends in literal fountains of blood, which yes. Always amused the hell out of me. I gravitated immediately, and again, I don't know what this is about me, but I gravitated immediately as a child to the most dark and inappropriate comedy that was available to consumers in Oklahoma. So.
Yeah, I you know, I did too. And this was one of the sketches I had seen on PBS. So I was rather young the first time I saw it. And the I guess you could use the word juxtaposition of the bright, sunny, cheery day of all the well-dressed people out in the field, the piano and the umbrellas and just being happy and gay and then suddenly the bloodbath. And I had no idea at the time who Sam Peckinpah was. Maybe that would have clued me into what was coming, but not knowing who he was. And, you know, it shocked me even more when that tennis ball hit Michael Palin's face and he throws his hand up into his face in pain and blood just starts spurting out of his face.
Oh, brilliant.
Pretty strong meat there from Sam.
Yes.
Peckinpah.
Stop sniffing.
Will you please stop sniffing?
Yeah, that's a good one. All right. Number one, Bill.
Number one. I wish to object to the use of the word juxtaposition. I find it a very tinny sounding word.
Ooh, tinny. Mm.
Which dovetails nicely into my personal number one sketch, Woody. I like to this day, I find words that sound Woody.
Gone.
Gone, dear?
Nothing. No, just like the word. It gives me confidence. Gone. Gone. It's got a sort of woody quality about it. Gone. Gone. Much better than newspaper or litter bin.
Oh, frightful words.
Perfectly dreadful.
Newspaper, litter bin, dreadful tinny sort of word. Tin, tin, tin.
Oh, dear, don't say tin to Rebecca. You know how it upsets her.
Sorry, old horse.
And I do like them, much like the word antelope. There's one woody word I will not say on air because this is an all-ages show. But, yes, I make no apologies for enjoying the Woody Ward sketch. And let's see, is there an actual title to this bad boy? If you haven't watched it yet.
Yeah, I don't know what it is. But while you're looking that up,
well, one of the Woody and Tinny words.
Woody and Tinny words. And Graham Chapman makes that sketch. Just I could sit there and listen to him say stuff like antelope.
That's
you
right.
know, I could hear him say that stuff. Over and
okay,
over.
Okay, hoops look damn pretty this afternoon. I assume that was written by Cleese and Graham Chapman, but I'm actually not sure. It feels very, very absurd and surrealist, even though it is kind of a thesaurus sketch. As they go through many words that are Woody or Tinny, the problem is that every time the poor daughter hears a Tinny word, she has to cover her ears, scream, and run from the room.
Yes, played by the excellent Carol Cleveland.
That's right.
Often cited by the members of Python themselves as the seventh Python.
Newspaper, litter bin, dreadful tinny sort of words. Tin, tin, tin.
Caribou. That's gone.
Right. Oh, dear. To Rebecca, you know how it upsets her. Sorry, old horse. Sausage. Yes. Sausage. There's a good Woody sort of word. Sausage. Gone. So, yes. You don't want an antelope nibbling the hoops, by the way. No. You want a croquet set made out of wood, not those awful tinny things. Tin, tin, tin. I walk around probably daily thinking to myself, Woody, tinny. Yuck. So
such a weird sketch. I mean, you're sitting there listening to that or watching that. And are they trying to say that the aristocracy of Britain have nothing better to do with their rich, pampered lives than to sit around and wonder which words are Woody and which words are tinny?
Oh, the good old days. You know, that's interesting. I've never it's never occurred to me to consider deeper meaning behind most things, right. That sketch. Yeah, but I'm the guy who notoriously doesn't. I don't think about movies while I'm watching them either. I turn my brain off, and whoever I'm watching a movie with will invariably go, "Well, blank is going to happen." I'm like, "Okay, well, I hadn't thought about that." So thanks to the assumed spoiler coming right up then. So
no, I'm the exact same way.
Yes.
There's a story I like to tell where I was listening to. Do you guys remember the Bullpen Bulletins podcast with David Price and Vince B?
Barely, yes. I'm aware of it.
And I believe I've talked to one of the two of those guys about this before, but this was way back in the day, like before we had started podcasting, probably. They had done an episode where they were talking about the first issue of Astonishing X-Men. And there's a moment in Astonishing X-Men where Kitty Pryde goes into the mansion, and she does so by phasing through the front door instead of opening it. And I remember listening to the episode, and Vince B is talking about how that's such a great moment in the issue because it clearly shows how she is connected to the X-Men, because for a moment there, as she's walking through that door, she's literally connected to the mansion, and he's reading all this subtext into it. And I remember listening to that going, really? I just thought it just meant that here's an easy way to show what her power set is. And you know, it's like there are people who can read books and watch shows and just see all that subtext. And I'm not one of them.
Steven, I'm right there with you, buddy. I find it kind of amazing occasionally as I self-reflect and think about something I've just watched, and that, I probably should have seen that coming a half hour ago, but I didn't. So yeah. It's okay. I consider that generally a boon that I turn my brain off and I just enjoy the ride, and I don't sit there and try to scry out the endings of these things.
That's right, because then we get surprised.
Thank you.
It's like, I did not see that coming. And what? Nobody,
right?
Everybody else saw it coming a mile away.
Right.
We get to enjoy it.
It's the first time I ever remember that that syndrome happening. I was at the theaters watching with my aforementioned childhood best friend, Kenny. And we were watching Angel Heart, which is a real rib tickler for those of you who've never seen it, by the way. But about halfway through it, spoilers, less than halfway through it, Kenny goes, that's Lucifer. And I go, well, that's the movie.
Exactly.
And I spent the last half of the movie going, well, it's the freaking devil. So I guess we kind of know what's going now. But yes.
My daughter, the aforementioned Palin, was at a friend's house, and they were watching The Sixth Sense. First time she's ever seen the movie.
Uh-oh.
And spoiler, the kid was dead the entire time.
The hell?
And she says that as she's watching it, at one point during the beginning, she looks at her friend and she goes, let me guess, he's dead. And she's like, well, I guess there's no point in watching the rest of this movie.
Oh, God.
And her friend knew. Her friend had seen it before.
See, I managed to get all the way to the end of Sixth Sense without without guessing the crazy twist. So
I was blown away.
Yes. No clue. So the one time I've seen that movie, I really enjoyed it.
Yeah. All right, Frank, you're number one.
My number one? The Battle of Pearl Harbor.
Oh, yes. Badly Townswomen's Guild.
because the pythons are in drag, they are playing posh women, and they make a total disaster of themselves fighting in the mud. And how that reflects to Pearl Harbor, I have no idea. But I love the brilliant silliness of it.
Miss Rita Fairbanks, you organized this reconstruction of the Battle of Pearl Harbor. Why?
Well, we've always been extremely interested in modern drama. We were, of course, the first Townswomen's Guild to perform Camp on Blood Island. And last year, of course, we did our extremely popular reenactment of Nazi war atrocities. So this year, we thought we'd like to do something in a lighter vein.
So you chose the Battle of Pearl Harbor?
Yes, that's right, we did.
Well, I can see you're all ready to go, so I'll just wish you good luck in your latest venture.
Thank you very much, young man.
Ladies and gentlemen, the World of History is proud to present the premiere of the Batley Townswomen's Guild reenactment of the Battle of Pearl Harbor.
You could almost say that the battle... well, no, I'm thinking of something else. Never mind.
I've never appreciated Monty Python more than in sketches like that, where you go, there was no point.
Yeah.
Right? And that's like the fish flapping dance. They got everybody together, put them in costume, drove out to this field, set up all their equipment, just so they could wrestle around in the mud and hit each other with their purses.
Some friends and I did that skit for it was at a party or something. We weren't in drag, but we someone had announced we were going to reenact the Battle of Pearl Harbor, and then proceeded just to wrestle, and we just thought it was the funniest thing.
That's funny. Yeah, that's a really good one. It's the second, because I know that the Batley Town Women's Guild was on another sketch reenacting some other war battle, World War II atrocities or something in general or something. And I don't remember which one it is, but before Eric Idle blows their little whistle and they all come out and fight, the guy, the announcer, Graham Chapman, is like, and now the Batley Townswomen Guild represent blah, blah, blah. And she looks at the camera and she goes, thank you very much, young man. And then she blows her little whistle, and then they all just come out of nowhere and just start fighting. It's so funny.
Yeah.
Very much.
I love the short kind of left field type of skits, where it's just like you're kind of and then is immediately cut off. I love it when a joke just kind of like ends and then you move on to the next thing. That's what Fish Slapping Dance does. That's what this one does too.
Yeah.
It just makes me laugh so much because it doesn't give you an opportunity to deconstruct it. It just happens and you move on.
Yep. It just keeps the show moving.
Yeah.
All right. Well, my number one, you'd already used, which is the fish slapping dance. So we've already talked about that. So let me talk about my, four, good Lord, I can't remember that word again.
Oh,
Bill, what am I looking for here? Honorable mentions. I thought
mention.
My four honorable mentions. The first one is a sketch called Flying Lessons, in which Terry Jones enters an office to get flying lessons, and he finds Graham Chapman hanging from the ceiling, and Graham Chapman's there to teach him how to fly like he is apparently flying and not how to fly a plane. And one of the greatest parts about that sketch is how Graham Chapman keeps he keeps getting annoyed by Terry Jones because he thinks Terry Jones is very, very haughty. So he's like, you're not flying. You're on a wire. Oh, I'm on a wire. Am I? Ooh. And he's like, here, let me get the oop. And he goes, what's an oop? And he goes, a hoop. And he holds up a hoop and he goes, oh, a hoop. Oh, an hoop. it's Graham Chapman's really good in that one.
Well, if people can't fly, what am I doing up here?
You're on a wire.
Oh, a wire. I'm on a wire, am I?
Of course you're on a bloody wire.
I am not on a wire. I am flying.
You're on a wire.
I am flying.
You're on a wire.
I'll show you whether I'm on a wire or not. Give me the oop.
What?
Oh, I don't suppose we know what an oop is. I suppose Peter thought they were a bit common, except on the bleeding croquet lawn.
Oh,
ew! And hoop. Thank you, your bleeding eyes. Now.
The Dull Life of a City Stockbroker. This is a nonverbal sketch with Michael Palin just going to work as a stockbroker and all these exciting things that happen around him that he doesn't notice. For example, he's standing in line for the bus and he's getting ready to get on the bus, and the four people behind him in line are suddenly attacked by Frankenstein, who just comes up from behind and one at a time knocks him on the head and knocks him out. And by the time he gets to Michael Palin, he boards the bus and Frankenstein snaps his fingers like, shucks, I missed it. And then as he's on the bus, a World War I battle breaks out all around him. Soldiers get on the bus and they're firing off the bus and there's explosions and just fun stuff like that. That's one of my favorites.
That's brilliant.
Bill already mentioned it earlier, the restaurant sketch where Graham Chapman complains about a dirty fork. And everybody just goes crazy, and the manager collapses, and John Cleese comes out and starts screaming at them, "You bastards!"
That's right.
And then they go, and now the punchline.
Worthy to lick.
Yeah. And they go, and now the punchline. And he says, "Good thing I didn't tell him about the dirty knife."
Yeah.
The audience goes, "Boo!" And,
lucky we didn't say anything about the dirty knife.
That's a great one. And then my last honorable mention is Bicycle Repairman.
Oh my goodness.
And I love that only for their great American accents. Most specifically the line told by John Cleese. See how he uses a spanner to tighten that nut.
Why, he's mending it with his own hand.
See how he uses a spanner to tighten that nut.
Doesn't John Cleese also start his own song, but it doesn't go anywhere? I must be confusing two skits. There is a skit, I thought it was Bicycle Repair, where someone comes out, they talk about something they'd rather be doing, they sing about it, I believe it's in a courtroom, and then John Cleese comes out and starts to sing too, now, but there's no music.
I also made a list of, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 of my favorite episodes, because some of my favorite sketches are part of episodes that it's just the episode is either a themed episode or it's, well, for example, the first one I have is episode 3, which is entitled How to Recognize Different Types of Trees from Quite a Long Way Away. And that sketch is in that episode, and it's the Cardinal Richelieu sketch.
Okay.
And Graham Chapman comes in. He is so-and-so of the yard. I can't remember his policeman's name, and somebody says, by God, you're smart. And he goes, have you always wanted to be a detective? And he says, no, and he sings a song. If I was not in the CID, something else I'd like to be. And it's about being a window washer. And then when he finishes his song, John Cleese, who is the barrister, if I was not before the bar, something else I'd like to be. If I was not a barrister, an engine driver, me. With a choof, 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 and a choof. And that's about when he notices that nobody else is singing. And he's like, choof, very uncomfortably walks off screen. Yeah.
By the way, identifying trees from a long ways away, least favorite skit.
Well, it's not really a sketch. It's just a linking device. And number three, the Lodge.
Yeah.
The Lodge. But it's as an episode, it's a great episode. It's got some great sketches in it. Let me look here. It's got that courtroom scene. It's got Bicycle Repairman. The restaurant sketches in that episode. The Seduced Milkman. Where the milkman follows the half-naked lady up the steps and she locks him in a room with other milkmen who have been there for years. The Stolen Newsreader is in that sketch. That's one of those genius sketches that just seems to go nowhere. John Cleese is at the desk reading the news, and suddenly three guys in striped shirts and masks bust in shooting guns, and you find that the desk is on wheels. And they wheel him out of the studio, and they put him in the back of a truck, and you have to sit here and watch as the truck drives along the highway the whole time. Yes. John Cleese is still reading the news, and then there's this long freaking shot of them wheeling the desk along this really long pier, and then they just dump him off the end, and then it's over. Then they just go to the next thing. It's such a wonderful sketch. Nudge, Nudge.
Oh, is in
that,
brilliant.
Is in that.
My goodness.
Children's Interview, which is when John Cleese is interviewing Michael Palin, Terry Jones, and Eric Idle, and they're supposed to be little kids. So they're on their knees. So I'd like to see Raquel Welch dropped on top of me. And the one of them is really nervous, and he goes, can you recognize different types of trees from long ways away? And Michael Palin just goes, I want to go home. That's a great one. I included from episode 27, Wicker's World or N'Jol's Saga, which is the great Icelandic saga.
Ah, yes.
Bill and I were talking a bit about that while your feed wasn't working. But this great Icelandic saga that they run out of money to produce, and then the town of Malden sponsors it. And then they start advertising throughout the saga, which is pretty good. And
is the one where that's on the beach, but they put white for snow.
No, that's Notch of the Antarctic. That's also okay. That's a great sketch. That is a great sketch. Let's see, what else did I have? Episode 34, The Cycling Tour, which is pretty much one continuous story with Michael Palin doing a cycling tour of North Cornwall and ends up in Russia. With Terry Jones, who thinks he is Trotsky or Karl Marx, one of them, and they end up staying at the AYMCA, the YMACA, the Young Man's Anti-Christian Association in Russia. Episode 40, The Golden Age of Ballooning. Love that one.
Balloon.
While it's not one continuous story, it does pretty much every sketch has something to do with ballooning. But there's a lot about the Montgolfier brothers who made the first hot air balloon. And Michael Palin plays a Scotsman posing as the king of France. Is it? I think he's Louis IV, and he keeps getting his number wrong. And he's there to steal the plans to the hot air balloon. And then I also last one, episode 44, Mr. Neutron. And that is worth it. Just again, Eric Idle and Michael Palin both play American characters in that show. And I love their American accents are the best. It's worth it to see Graham Chapman in his Mr. Neutron costume with his giant shoulder pads and his skinny legs.
That final season I'm not that familiar with.
The final season's only like seven episodes or something. Mm-hmm. But it's got some classic stuff in there. It's, you know, it to me that last season, which didn't have John Cleese, to me is a lot like The Meaning of Life. I think most people consider it the worst of their four seasons or their series, as they say in Britain. But it's got some great stuff in it, and Mr. Neutron is one of those.
That one I need to be reminded. I'll have to look that one up online because I can visualize it a little bit.
There's the there's an American agency that discovers that Mr. Neutron is free and he's the most powerful man in the universe and they have to find him. And Michael Palin plays some American general or something, and he just starts having all these cities all across the world bombed just in case. And it's really good. And there's a lot of moments with him who he's behind his desk and he's discovered some kind of smell. He's just sitting there and he's sniffing and he can't tell if the smell is coming from him. So in various parts of the episode, you come across him and he's got his shirt off and he's smelling under his arms and he's sniffing various places on his body. And just and then they send Eric Idle out to find Teddy Salad, who's the greatest secret agent ever. And he's a master of disguise. And we find out that he's disguised as a dog. And he's had to have like most of his limbs removed to get into the dog costume. And it's really good stuff.
Okay.
He goes to the Yukon. And then, of course, just as Teddy Salad is about to give him the secret to stopping Mr. Neutron, they bomb the Yukon. And that's it. Any other episodes or sketches stand out for you guys?
Well, I would just say that I think that of the sketches I did not mention in my top five, I would list in my honorable mention category. Let me think. Every other sketch. So
other one.
I'm sorry if that sounds like a cop out. That's how it goes. Monty Python is like pizza. Even bad pizza is still pretty dang good.
Here. That is a great statement, Bill.
Thank you.
I agree.
Clearly, that's why I'm here this morning.
So do you guys have a favorite Python, Frank?
Yeah, you know, I was thinking about it. I think I have to go with Cleese, and that's mostly when he yells or he acts a self-righteous character. I love it when he does that, especially in the argument clinic. That one just really speaks to me. So Cleese is my favorite.
Bill?
I always identified, I think, most with Michael Palin. And I'm sorry if I'm stealing thunder here. But again, I love and appreciate all of them. But yeah, I'd have to say Michael Palin, probably for his goofy faces. But again, it's like trying to, you know, it's like, hey, which is your favorite child?
Yes.
So, yeah. You know, it's not this is kind of a 1A, 1B, 1C, 1D, 1E thing, not 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And I, you know, back there was a time back in the day when I used to run my own Monty Python website called Pythonland, and I had categorized each one of the Pythons. And I it wasn't something that I came up with. I had grabbed it from other sources, but
I remember you had Eric Idle as the greedy Python.
Yeah. Eric Idle, the greedy one.
Yeah.
Terry Jones, the Welsh one. Michael Palin, the nice one. John Cleese, the tall one. Terry Gilliam, the American one. And then Graham Chapman, the dead one.
Oh.
But I can't do that now because of Terry Jones.
Yeah. So. Well, but you were saying about your website.
Well, because he mentioned Michael Palin, I was going to say, yeah, Michael Palin's the nice one. There is, I don't know if you've ever seen it, and it used to be on Netflix. I don't know if it is anymore. But the BBC, I think it was, did a dramatization, you know, one of those biopic type movies about like the Monty Python versus whoever it was when they tried to ban The Life of Brian.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You know, when it came out and there was a lot of places that wouldn't play it. And then John Cleese and Michael Palin went on a talk show with like a religious figure and some conservative, and they debated. Well, they made a movie out of that. They made a TV movie where different people played the Pythons, and it's a really good, if you ever, God, I can't even think of it. I think it's just called Monty Python Versus, maybe. I don't know, but it's there's a book about it and there's this movie about it that used to be on streaming, and Don't know if it still is anymore, but it's really good. If you ever run across it, it's something okay. to watch.
Is it more dramatic? I imagine there's some silly stuff in it, but I guess
it's a mix of both because it is supposed to be a dramatic retelling. But because it's Monty Python, I feel like they added a bunch of weird, maybe some animation type stuff in it every once in a while. I remember they made it Python-esque, which is an actual word now. But it was one of those things because I'd always, you know, growing up and watching the documentaries and stuff, it was always in Python. The two leading figures to me were always John Cleese on one side and Terry Gilliam on the other, or Terry Jones on the other. And they were always butting heads. But when the show was made, the two most famous Pythons at the time were John Cleese and Michael Palin. John Cleese was known for the Frost Report. They all at one point worked on the Frost Report as writers with David Frost, except for Terry Gilliam. But John Cleese actually had a lot of on-camera stuff in the Frost Report. And then Michael Palin had his own like weird pop show or something on TV at one point before Python. So those two were actually the two, as far as the public were concerned in Britain, they were the two most famous in the show and the most recognizable. Now, growing up, and even today when I talk to people today, tell me if you guys have gotten the same thing. First, people think that Monty Python was one of them and that Monty Python was John Cleese. You guys ever heard that?
I've never come across that.
People tell me that all the time. Oh, yeah, I like Monty Python. Wasn't John Cleese Monty Python? And then I got to go, well, no. And then I have to explain it to them, and then eventually they walk away because I'm being a nerd. Sure. I think it's
because I surround myself with nerds that never happens.
I've gotten to the point in my life where I get into certain groups of people that I don't even like to tell them that I'm a Monty Python fan because there's always one person that knows everything about Monty Python, and then they'll start telling you everything they know. And everything they know is completely wrong. I had a guy 10, 15 years ago who told me that Michael Palin was the one that died and there was nothing I could do to convince him otherwise. And I just get to the point anymore now where I just smile and nod.
Yeah, I'm a smile and nod or two. I've given up just trying to correct people on stuff and like pop culture stuff or things of that nature because it's just like, oh, okay. Yeah. No, like I guess the Dallas Cowboys did start in Houston first. So okay, yes.
Yeah, yeah I've become that type too. I'll clear my conscience and I will tell them what I'm pretty sure the correct answer is. And then when you invariably get that nope, Michael Palin's on the diet, I'll just go okay,
I guess I'm wrong.
Okay.
Yeah. Give him the big thumbs up and the big cheeky smile.
Someday in 30 years, you'll read something, go, oh, and then you'll probably will have forgotten it anyway. So what the heck?
Yeah, it's that moment during a conversation that you quickly realize that whoever it is you're talking to, you've never met him before. You'll probably never see him again. Their opinion doesn't mean anything. Just smile and nod and walk away.
It's tough when that happens with coworkers because invariably my opinion of them goes way down. You're talking about a letter grade.
Yeah. So real quick, because I'm sure my audience will demand it, Bill, including, and now for something completely different, which is your favorite movie?
Holy cow. That's a great question. I am going to go ahead and go with, I'll say the Holy Grail. It was the first, and like many Monty Python things, it doesn't age a day. It's still just as funny today as it was the first time I saw it, probably 40 years ago. So, yep. Well, 30 to 35 years ago, probably. I wish I could think of something besides one of their three big movies, but I can't, so I won't, and I'm done.
Frank?
I have to mirror everything Bill said. That movie is pretty close to perfect. As a comedy.
My answer has always been Holy Grail is the classic. That's the one that if anybody knows anything about Monty Python, it's the Holy Grail.
Yes.
But my favorite of the four has always been Life of Brian.
Oh, okay.
Now, having said that, a number of years back, my my stepbrother, my wife's older brother, gets a hold of me one day and he says, "Hey, I got these tickets. John Cleese, he was on this tour. He had a book and he was coming to Topeka, Kansas, and we were going to go." I said, "Yes, of course." We went to see a screening of The Holy Grail on the big screen, the first time I'd ever seen The Holy Grail on the big screen. And then John Cleese came out after and answered questions. And there's something about watching this movie that I could probably sit down and recite almost word from word just from memory. But there's something about watching that movie in a room full of people who love the movie just as much as I do. I find myself laughing more and having way much more fun with it, even though we got stuck in the very front row, right dead center, which was great for when John Cleese was on stage, but for the movie screen, it really hurt your neck after a while. But,
yeah.
But it was a wonderful experience. And then, of course, John Cleese comes out, and I had taken my daughter Palin with me because he had four tickets, one for himself, one for myself. He took his daughter, and then I ended up taking Palin with me. And there was a moment when John Cleese was out. They had a thing set up in the lobby where you could – where they had these papers with pens and you could write down questions and then they chose which ones they were going to ask. They had a guy sit there with them and pulling questions out. And at one point, John Cleese, who has been married multiple times, he starts talking about marriage and he starts talking about kids. And at one point, he starts talking about how terrible children are and how kids are the worst. They're the worst thing in the world. And as he's saying it, he looks down because, like I said, we're right in the front row, dead center. He looks down and he sees Palin and he just says, "Not you, dear. You're wonderful." That's like the one thing Palin's always like, "John Cleese, talk to me." Yeah, he did.
That is such a wonderful rant from Cleese. I can totally hear him saying that.
Yeah, nowadays I think I would categorize him as the grumpy one.
He has become grumpy. The older he's become. Yeah. He's
yeah.
Gotten to be quite the curmudgeon. All right. Well, this episode has gone way longer than many of my episodes. I may have to end up splitting this sucker into two.
Hey, do it.
And just releasing one on Tuesday and then one on Thursday. But I'm trying to find my email real quick where I had run down some of the stuff that I thought we should talk about. I think we covered most everything. Let's see. We talked about our first time we were exposed to Monty Python, who our favorite Python is, favorite movie, our favorite sketches. Frank, you haven't listened to all the albums, so we won't do the favorite albums.
Yeah, unfortunately, I wouldn't be able to participate in that part.
Yeah, that's okay. Maybe we'll come back at some point. We'll do
that. Yeah.
Frank has now listened to all the Monty Python albums.
Nice. We'll be there for that.
Because there really is. You're going to hear stuff you've never heard before. And the stuff that they have out there on the streaming services like YouTube Music and Spotify and Apple Music and whatnot, they are re-releases from just a few years back. And I have found that there are bonus tracks on those that I had never before heard because I had bought this, it was like the Monty Python box set that had all of their albums on CD in one set. And this is a newer version of those albums, and there's bonus stuff on them. So a number of years back, I got to hear new Monty Python stuff I'd never heard before. So that was kind of fun.
I do recall one album that I listened to, and it starts off with someone describing the album and how it's made of quality material.
Yes.
And the joke in there is like, and there's only one curse word in fart and fart, which happens here or something like that.
Yeah. That's the Holy Grail soundtrack because it's okay. The executive version. It's
yes.
Basically you're listening to a higher quality version than everybody else. And yeah, there's little to no offensive material apart from, and I'm not going to use the words, but
yeah.
there are four or five different curse words they say. And then, yeah, he goes, and as we've just said them, you'll pass them now.
Yes. Which I always thought was brilliant. That yeah. Little part.
Yes. That's Graham Chapman. It's funny because as you listen to the soundtracks to each of the movies. You've got the Holy Grail soundtrack, which, like I said, they just went above and beyond. There is so much new stuff in that. It's almost like they said, you know what? There's really not enough from this movie that we could put on this album and make an actual album out of. So we've got to add a bunch of stuff in there to really pad it out. And then you get to Life of Brian, and they do something similar, but it's only Graham Chapman and Eric Idle doing any of the new stuff. And it's like Graham Chapman plays a guy in the studio who's linking the various scenes together from the movie on the album. And Eric Idle's the guy in the booth, the director. And so Graham Chapman's trying to read from this script, and he gets certain things wrong, and Eric Idle has to correct him at times. And so there's a lot of that in that soundtrack. So it's like new stuff, but it's not on this in the same scale as the Holy Grail. And then by Life of, well, then by Meaning of Life, I don't know that there's any new stuff in that. It's like they've just, by that point, they're like, whatever, just throw some stuff. We're not even going to be involved. Just throw some stuff together on the album and put it out there. I don't remember if there's any, because there's plenty of songs in that movie. And, you know, between the songs and the sketches that work well in audio, I don't think they added anything new to that. But I'd be interested to hear what you think once you get through them. You might, you know, if you want to be a real nerd about it, go online and find out which, you know, the order of release and listen to them by the order of release. And I don't know if it's even out there, but they actually did an album that is just, I think they just took the audio straight from the shows and made an album out of the first series or something. I've only listened through that once, but.
Yeah. It's obviously that some of these have been remastered because, another Monty Python record, according to this listing, was 2014. And then, contractual obligation is 206, so or 26. So, yeah, they've obviously added more material to what I can see here. But I'll just find a plain order, and that'll be fun to listen to them while I walk and drive and stuff.
Yeah, I'm trying to find the discography. I just want to see what's on some of these records.
I'm looking at 11 albums.
Yeah, another Monty Python record has a lot of this stuff is from the show. Like Bill said, contractual obligation album is pretty much all new stuff.
I did say that.
Yeah. Monty Python's previous record. Oh, Are You Embarrassed Easily? That's a good one. That's got that. Okay, that one has the Fish License sketch on it, which the first time I heard the Fish License was through audio. And it includes a song that was not in the show called Eric the Half-A-Bee, which is sung by John Cleese, who's not a singer. Ah. And it's one of my favorite songs in the world. And the sketch is so much better in audio than on the show. When I watch it on the show, I was actually quite disappointed because the sketch in audio, I think, is so much funnier. That's just the one thing I've heard them talk about the albums before, and they talk about the difference between doing a sketch on the show and on an album is that when you do it on the show, in essence, a lot of these you're doing in front of an audience. So you just got one take. You just do the sketch. But on an album, you can do it. You can do various takes, and you can find the beats a little bit better as far as when lines should come and all that stuff. And I think that's why Eric the Half-A-Bee, but the Fish License sketch for me, I think works better on audio, but it's probably just because I heard it first on audio and listened to it over and over and over before I ever saw it on the show.
That's exactly right. That's so weird. I keep noticing I keep getting closer and further to the table. It's really strange. That's a joke for all the people watching this on video, by the way. Actually, it's not much of a joke at all. I take it back. I take it all back. My apologies for wasting
time. I think Frank is trying to trick us. He looks like he's frozen. He's not frozen. I can see him moving. I can see slight movements in his face.
I was trying to hide my eyes so you wouldn't be able to see.
Your eyes is that's what was moving. I could see your eyes kind of darting back and forth a little.
Okay. Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you guys for joining me on this what will probably end up being two episodes because we went for a really, really long time. And, you know, frankly, when I had problems with Skype, this probably will be a good spot to cut the episodes in half because I think we recorded for a little over an hour and then I had to start over, and then which saved, thankfully. But now we've recorded again for about an hour and 20 minutes. So
brilliant. I fully expect you to leave off in between the first and second episode with a massive, massive cliffhanger. Don't let me down, Stephen.
Oh, my God. Now I have to work on something.
Oh, you have to use the intermission music from Holy Grail.
Of course. I've got it. I got it saved. I've got a bank of sounds and whatnot that I can use. And that's definitely one of them. I've used it before. In fact, there's I don't remember which album it is, but it opens with Terry Jones screaming, "Not this record, not this record." And he starts screaming. And then there's this record scratch just goes. And I use that record scratch a lot in my shows when I want to quickly transition from something. And I'll be using it at the beginning. If you listen, you'll hear it at the beginning when we did that opening where I pretend that we ended the show. There'll be a record scratch there.
Yes. That's proper.
Hey, there's another cat behind Bill. How many cats you got?
Just two.
Two, yeah. That looks very much like one of our cats.
That's Mr. Tumnus, which Mr. dates Tumnus. The day we got him.
That's from A Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, correct?
Bang, boom. Yes.
All right, Frank, tell us a little about Half Hour Wasted before we close this sucker up.
No. Nobody needs to know about Half Hour Wasted.
Currently, we are on hiatus, but we have a wonderful back catalog that you can listen to. I'm sure we'll be back up and running at any time. But Half Hour Wasted is everyone's favorite pop culture show where we talk about comic books, movies, television, and it's hosted by two terrific guys and Bill. And... And give us a listen because we would appreciate it. We are commercial free because no one will pay to put ads on our show.
It's funny because when Brad was going to be on the show with us, and he's not, and trust me, he will pay for that. I had originally planned when I was introducing you guys, when I got to Bill, I was going to say, and last, but certainly not first, Bill McGon.
Cheers to you.
Bill, we love you. We always rib him on the show.
Oh, man.
Of course we do. So do you guys remember the very first time? Because I've been on Half Hour Wasted twice now. Mm-hmm. You remember the very first time I was on?
Let's see. I believe it was Monty Python related.
Yes, it was.
Yeah. It was talking about your website.
Yeah. And I had to leave in the middle of it because my son, who at the time was maybe five, maybe four. He had a little toy guitar and a string broke, and he was having a meltdown.
Oh.
And now he's 19, and his meltdowns are much bigger, and his guitars are real.
So. Dad!
Yep. The time does fly. The young 2 or 3 year old who introduces the three of us at the beginning of each episode is now a ninth grader playing football.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Something like that.
I mean, it's just insane. I see pictures of Brad's daughters sometimes on Instagram, and I'm just like, nah, that can't be. I mean, they would every once in a while, you know, like your kids, Bill, would show up on the podcast every once in a while. More Bill's kids, because you guys at one point did a lot of your recordings at your house.
Definitely.
Those are the good old days.
Yeah. So, it's just crazy how time flies. All right, fellas, let me wrap up the show. I don't do anything special. I just tell everybody that join me next time for fun stuff and hijinks and whatever the heck I feel like talking about that week. And until then, my name is Steven, and I'm just another fanboy. Be nice to each other.
Bye-bye, Daddy.
Bye-bye, Daddy.
Good job.
And that's how I close the shows.
Go Shenanigans. Oh, I think Brad's hopping on.
No, he's not.
Good timing, Brad. Let's see.
Is he really?
My dog is actually going a bit bananas right now. Here, let me see. Brad, did you get a text from Brad?
No, Will was messing with us.
No, I was totally joking. That was 100% joke.
Yeah. You know, I was, this is no longer part of the episode, but I was doing an episode with Harold Jennett a couple of weeks back.
I know.
And Harold used to, whenever he would be on the show, you know, I used to do the whole intro like we, you know, during these live recordings when I had a guest on. And Harold always liked to interrupt me and when I would do them. And so the last time he was on, I was like, I'll be doing the intro separately. And he was saying, oh, because you don't want me to interrupt you. And I said, no, actually, it's all Frank Rincon's fault. And I told him about you shaving during the intro.
Oh, yeah.
That's not really why I do it. But it's still, I think, one of the best moments. You shaving with an electric razor and then Bill or Brad trying to one up you when he was on and trying to shave with an actual razor and didn't quite work out for him.
That Brad fail is so funny to me because he admits defeat pretty quickly. Yeah. And I think at one point he goes, oh, man, this was a bad idea.
Yeah. And so then he had to try to get all this shaving cream off his face.
That was dumb.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.